It was an hour later. The librarian knuckled and swung through the midnight drizzle, head exploding with music. He landed on the lawns of Unseen University and ran into the great hall, hands waving wildly overhead to maintain balance. He stopped. Moonlight filtered in through the big windows, illuminating what the Arch-Chancellor always referred to as our mighty organ, to the general embarrassment of the rest of the faculty. Rack upon rack of pipes entirely occupied one wall, looking like pillars in the gloom, or possibly resembling the stalagmites of some monstrously ancient cave. Almost lost among them was the player's pulpit, with its three giant keyboards and the 100 knobs for special sound effects. It wasn't often used, except for the occasional civic affair, or Wizards Excuse Me. Wizards did not have balls. There was a popular song about it, but they did hold their annual Excuse Me, or free-for-all dance, which was one of the highlights of the Ankh-Morpork social calendar. The librarian, in particular, always looked forward to it, and used an amazing amount of hair cream. But the librarian, energetically pumping the bellows and making the occasional little woo-oops of excitement, felt there was a lot more that it could do. A fully grown male orangutan may look like an amiable pile of old carpets, but he has a strength in him that would make a human of equivalent weight eat lots of rug. The librarian only stopped pumping when the lever was too hot to hold and the air reservoirs were farting and whistling around the rivets. Then he swung himself up into the organist's seat. The whole edifice was humming softly under the enormous pent-up pressure. The librarian locked his hands together and cracked his knuckles, which is impressive when you have as many knuckles as an orangutan. He raised his hands. He hesitated. He lowered his hands again and pulled out the Vox Humana, the Vox Dei, and the Vox Diabolica. The moan of the organ took on a more urgent tone. He raised his hands. He hesitated. He lowered his hands and pulled out all the rest of the stops, including the 12 knobs with question mark on them, and the two with faded labels warning in several languages that they were on no account to be touched ever in any circumstances. He raised his hands. He raised his feet also, positioning them over some of the more perilous pedals. He shut his eyes. He sat for a moment in contemplative silence, a test pilot, ready to slit the edge of the envelope in the starship melody. He let the plangent memory of the music fill his head and flow down his arms and fill his fingers. His hands dropped.
"What did we do? What did we do?" said Imp.
Excitement ran its barefoot races up and down his spine. They were sitting in the tiny cramped room behind the bar. Glod took off his helmet and wiped the inside.
"Would you believe 4 beats to the bar, 2-4-time melody led with the bass beat forward in the melody?"
"What's all that?" said Leas. "What's all them words mean?"
"You're a musician, ain't you?" said Glod. "What do you think you do?"
"I hits them with the hammers," said Leas, one of nature's drummers.
"But that bit you did," said Imp. "You know, in the middle, you know, bum-bum-bum-bum-ba-bum-ba. How did you know to do that bit?"
"It was just the bit that had to go there," said Leas.
Imp looked at the guitar. He'd put it on the table. It was still playing quietly to itself, like a cat purring.
"That's not a normal instrument," he said, shaking a finger at it. "I was just standing there, and it started playing all by itself."
"Probably belonged to a wizard, like I said," said Glod.
"Nah," said Leas. "Never knew any wizard who was musical. Music and magic don't mix."
They looked at it. Imp had never heard of an instrument that played itself before, except the legendary harp of Owen Mwini, which sang when danger threatened. And that had been back in the days when there were dragons around. Singing harps went well with dragons. They seemed out of place in a city with guilds and everything. The door swung open.
"That was astonishing, boys," said Hibiscus Dunelm. "Never heard anything like it. Can you come back tomorrow night? Here's your $5.
Glod counted the coins.
"We did 4 encores," he said darkly.
"I'd complain to the guild if I was you," said Hibiscus.
The trio looked at the money. It looked very impressive to people whose last meal had been 24 hours ago. It wasn't guild rate. On the other hand, it had been a long 24 hours.
"If you come back tomorrow," said Hibiscus, "I'll make it $6. How about that?"
"Oh, wow," said Glod.
Mustrum Ridcully was jolted upright in bed because the bed itself was being gently vibrated across the floor.
"So
It had happened at last. They were out to get him. The tradition of promotion in the university by filling dead men's shoes, sometimes by firstly ensuring the death of the man in those shoes, had lately ceased. This was largely because of Ridcully himself, who was big and kept himself in trim, and as three late-night aspirants to the Arch-Chancellorship had found, also had very good hearing. They had been variously hung out of the window by their ankles, knocked unconscious with a shovel, and had their arm broken in two places. Besides, Ridcully was known to sleep with two loaded crossbows by his bed. He was a kind man, and probably wouldn't shoot you in both ears. That sort of consideration encouraged a more patient type of wizard. Everyone dies sooner or later. They could wait. Ridcully took stock and found his first impression was mistaken. There appeared to be no murderous magic going on. There was just sound, cramming the room to every corner. Ridcully shuffled into his slippers and went out into the corridor, where other members of the faculty were milling around and blearily asking one another what the hell was happening. Plaster rained down on them from the ceiling in a steady fog.
Who's causing that din?"
shouted Ridcully. There was a mute chorus of unheard replies and much shrugging of shoulders.
"Well, I will find out,"
growled the Arch-Chancellor, and set off for the stairs, with the others trailing after him. He walked without his knees or elbows bending very much, a sure sign of a forthright man in a bad temper. The trio said nothing all the way out of the drum. They said nothing all the way to Gimlet's Delicatessen. They said nothing while they waited in the queue, and then all they said was, "So, right, that's one Quattro Rodenti with extra newts, hold the chilies, one Clachian Hots with double salami, and a fourth strata, no pitch blend." They sat down to wait. The guitar played a little four-note riff. They tried not to think about it. They tried to think about other things.
"I think I'll change my name," said Lias, eventually. "I mean, Lias. Not a good name for the music business."
"What'll you change it to?" said Glod.
"I thought..." "Don't laugh. I thought..."
"Cliff," said Lias.
"Cliff? Good troll name. Very stony, very rocky. Nothing wrong with it," said Cliff, nay Lias, defensively.
"Well, yes, but, I dunno. I mean, well, Cliff. Can't see anyone lasting long in this business with a name like Cliff."
"Better than Glod, anyway."
"I'm sticking with Glod," said Glod. "And Imp is sticking with Imp, right?"
Imp looked at the guitar. "It's not right," he thought. "I hardly touched it. I just... And I feel so tired. I..."
"Not sure," he said, wretchedly. "Not sure if Imp is the right name for the... for this music."
His voice trailed off. He yawned.
"Imp?" said Glod, after a while.
"Hmm?"
said Imp. And he'd felt someone was watching him out there. That was daft, of course. He couldn't say to someone, "I was on stage and I thought someone was watching me." They'd say,
"Really? That's really occult, that is."
"Imp," said Glod, "why are you snapping your fingers like that?"
Imp looked down.
"Was I?"
"Yes."
"Just thinking. My name, it's not right for this music either."
"What does it mean in real language?" said Glod.
"Well, all my family are Ekelins,"
said Imp, ignoring the insult to an ancient tongue.
"It means of the holly. That's all that grows in Hlamedos, you see. Everything else just rots."
"I wasn't going to say," said Cliff, "but Imp sounds a bit like elf to me."
"It just means small shoot," said Imp. "You know, like a bud."
"Bud Ekelin," said Glod. "Buddy. Worse than Cliff, in my opinion."
"Ah, I think it sounds right," said Imp.
Glod shrugged and pulled a handful of coins out of his pocket.
"We've still got more than $4, he said. "I know what we should do with it, too."
"We should put it towards guild membership,"
said the new buddy. Glod stared into the middle distance.
"No," he said. "We haven't got the sound right. I mean, it was very good. Very new."
He stared hard at Imp come buddy.
"But there's still something missing."
The dwarf gave buddy, nay Imp, another penetrating stare.
"Do you know you're shaking all over?" he said, "moving around on your seat like you've got a pant full of ant."
"I can't help it," said Buddy.
He wanted to sleep, but a rhythm was bouncing around inside his head.
"'I saw it too,' said Cliff. "'When we was walking here, you were bouncing along.'
He looked under the table. "'And you is tapping your feet.' "'And you keep snapping your fingers,' said Claude.
"'I can't stop thinking about the music,' said Buddy. "'You're right. We need—'
He drummed his fingers along the table.
"'A sound like bang, 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 bang.
"'You mean a keyboard?' said Claude.
"'Do I?'
"'They've got one of those new pianofortes just over the river in the opera house,' said Claude.
"'Yeah, but that sort of thing ain't for our kind of music,' said Cliff. "'That sort of thing is for big fat guys in powdered wigs.'
"'I reckon,' said Claude, giving Buddy another lopsided stare, "'if we put it anywhere near near Buddy, it'll be for our kind of music soon enough. "'So go and get it.'
"'I heard where it cost $400,' said Cliff. "'No one's got that many teeth.'
"'I didn't mean buy it,' said Claude. "'Just borrow it for a while.'
"'That's stealing,' said Cliff.
"'No, it's not,' said the dwarf. "'We'll let them have it back when we finish with it.'
"'Oh, that's all right, then.'
Buddy wasn't a drummer or a troll, and he could see the technical flaw in Glod's argument, and a few weeks ago he'd have said so. But then he'd been a good circle-going boy from the valleys who didn't drink, didn't swear, and played the harp at every druidic sacrifice. Now he needed that piano. The sound had been nearly right. He snapped his fingers in time with his thoughts.
"'But we ain't got anyone to play it,' said Cliff.
"'You get the piano,' said Glod. "'I'll get the piano player.' And all the time they kept glancing at the guitar. The wizards advanced in a body towards the organ. The air around it vibrated as if superheated.
"'What an unholy noise!' shouted the lecturer in recent runes.
"'Oh, I don't know,' screamed the dean. "'It's rather catchy.'
Blue sparks crackled between the organ pipes. The librarian could just be seen high in the trembling structure.
"'Who's pumping it?'
screamed the senior wrangler. Ridcully looked around at the side. The handle seemed to be going up and down by itself.
"'I'm not having this,' he muttered. "'Not in my damn university. It's worse than students.'
And he raised his crossbow and fired, right at the main bellows. There was a long, drawn-out wail, in the key of A, and then the organ exploded. The history of the subsequent seconds was put together during a discussion in the uncommon room, where the wizards went for a stiff drink, or in the bursar's case, a warm milk, shortly afterwards. The lecturer in recent runes swore that the 60-foot gravissimo organ pipe went skywards on a pillar of flame. The chair of indefinite studies and the senior wrangler said that when they found the librarian upside down in one of the fountains in Sartor Square, outside the university, he was going, "Ook, ook," to himself, and grinning. The bursar said that he'd seen a dozen naked young women bouncing up and down on his bed, but the bursar occasionally said things like this anyway, especially when he'd been indoors a lot. The dean said nothing at all. His eyes were glazed. Sparks crackled in his hair. He was wondering if he'd be allowed to paint his bedroom black. The beat went on. The lifetimer of Imp stood in the middle of the huge desk. The Death of Rats walked around it, squeaking under his breath. Susan looked at it too. There was no doubt that all the sand was in the bottom bulb, but something else had filled the top and was pouring through the pinch. It was pale blue and coiling in frantically on itself like excited smoke.
"Have you ever seen anything like it?" she said.
"Squeak!"
"Nor me."
Susan stood up. The shadows around the walls, now that she'd got used to them, seemed to be of things. Not exactly machinery, but not exactly furniture either. There had been an orrery on the lawn at college. The distant shapes put her in mind of it, although what stars it measured and in what dark courses she really couldn't say. They seemed to be projections of things too strange even for this strange dimension. She'd wanted to save his life. And that was right, she knew it. As soon as she'd seen his name, she... Well, it wasn't important. She'd inherited some of Death's memory. She couldn't have met the boy, but perhaps he had. She felt that the name and the face had established themselves so deeply in her mind now that the rest of her thoughts were forced to orbit them. Something else had saved him first. She held the lifetimer up to her ear again. She found herself tapping her foot, and realized that the distant shadows were moving. She ran across the floor, the real floor, the one outside the boundaries of the carpet. The shadows looked more like mathematics would be if it was solid. There were vast curves of something. Pointers like clock hands, but longer than a tree, moved slowly through the air. The Death of Rats climbed onto her shoulder.
"I suppose you don't know what's happening?"
"Squeak."
Susan nodded. Rats, she supposed, died when they should. They didn't try to cheat or return from the dead. There were no such things as zombie rats. Rats knew when to give up. She looked at the glass again. The boy, and she used the term as girls will of young males several years older than them, the boy had played a chord on the guitar or whatever it was, and history had been bent, or had skipped or something. Something besides her didn't want him dead. It was 2 o'clock in the morning and raining. Constable Detritus, Ankh-Morpork City Watch, was guarding the Opera House. It was an approach to policing that he'd picked up from Sergeant Colon. When you were all by yourself in the middle of a rainy night, go and guard something big with handy overhanging eaves. Colon had pursued this policy for years, as a result of which no major landmark had ever been stolen. Well, except for Unseen University once, but that was just a student prank. It had been an uneventful night. About an hour earlier, a 64-foot organ pipe had dropped out of the sky. Detritus had wandered over to inspect the crater, but he wasn't quite certain if this was criminal activity. Besides, for all he knew, this was how you got organ pipes. For the last 5 minutes, he'd also been hearing muffled thumps and the occasional tinkling noise from inside the opera house. He'd made a note of it. He did not wish to appear stupid. Detritus had never been inside the opera house. He didn't know what sound it normally made at 2 a.m. The front doors opened, and a large, oddly shaped, flat box came out hesitantly. It advanced in a curious way, a few steps forward, a couple of steps back. And it was also talking to itself. Detritus looked down. He could see, he paused, at least 7 legs of various sizes, only 4 of which had feet. He shambled across to the box and banged on the side.
"Hello! Hello! What's all this, then?"
he said, concentrating to get the sentence right. The box stopped. Then it said,
"We're a piano."
Detritus gave this due consideration. He wasn't sure what a piano was.
Piano move about, does it?"
he said.
"We've got legs," said the piano.
Detritus conceded the point.
"But it out the middle of the night,"
he said.
"Even pianos have to have time off,"
said the piano. Detritus scratched his head. This seemed to cover it.
"Well, all right,"
he said. He watched the piano jerk and wobble down the marble steps and round the corner. It carried on talking to itself.
"How long have we got, do you think? We ought to make it to the bridge. He's not clever enough to be a drummer. But he's a policeman.
So?
Cliff?"
"Yep."
"We might get caught."
"He can't stop us. We're on a mission from God."
"Right."
The piano tottered onward through the puddles for a little while, and then asked itself,
"Buddy?"
"Yep."
"Why did I just say that?"
"Say what?"
"About us being on a mission, you know, from God."
"Well, the dwarf said to us, go and get the piano, and his name is God, so..."
Yeah, right, right. "But he could have stopped us. I mean, there's nothing special about some mission from some dwarf."
"Maybe you were just a bit tired."
"Maybe that's it,"
said the piano gratefully.
"Anyway, we are on a mission from God."
"Yep."
God sat in his lodgings watching the guitar. It had stopped playing when Buddy had gone out, although if he put his ear close to the strings he was sure that they were still humming very gently. Now he very carefully reached out and touched the... To call the sudden snapping sound discordant would be too mild. The sound had a snarl. It had talons. Glod sat back. Right, right. It was Buddy's instrument. An instrument played by the same person over the years could become very adapted to them, although not in Glod's experience to the point of biting someone else. Buddy hadn't had it a day yet, but the principle, maybe, was the same. There was an old dwarf legend about the famous Horn of Fergal, which sounded itself when danger was near, and also in the presence, for some reason, of horseradish. And there was even an Ankh-Morpork legend, wasn't there, about some old drum in the palace or somewhere that was supposed to bang itself if an enemy fleet was seen sailing up the Ankh? The legend had died out in recent centuries, partly because this was the Age of Reason, and also because no enemy fleet could sail up the Ankh without a gang of men with shovels going in front. And there was a troll story about some stones that on frosty nights... The point was that magical instruments turned up every so often. Glod reached out again. All right, all right. The old music shop was right up against the university, after all, and magic did leak out, despite what the wizards always said about talking rats and walking trees just being statistical flukes. But this didn't feel like magic. It felt a lot older than that. It felt like music. Glod wondered whether he should persuade Imp, Buddy, to take it back to the shop and get a proper guitar. On the other hand, $6 was $6, at least. Something hammered on the door. "Who's that?" said Glod, looking up. The pause outside was long enough to let him guess. He decided to help out. "Cliff?" he said.
"Yep. Got a piano here."
"Bring it on in."
"Had to break off the legs and the lid and a few other bits, but it's basically okay."
"Bring it on in, then."
"Door's too narrow."
Buddy, coming up the stairs behind the troll, heard the crunch of woodwork.
"Try it again."
"Fits perfectly."
There was a piano-shaped hole around the doorway. Glod was standing next to it, holding his axe. Buddy looked at the wreckage all over the landing.
"What the hell are you doing?" he said. "That's someone else's wall."
"Well, it's someone else's piano."
"Yes, but you can't just hack holes in the wall."
"What's more important, some wall or getting the sound right?" said Glod. Buddy hesitated. Part of him thought, "That's ridiculous, it's only music." Another part of him thought, rather more sharply, "That's ridiculous, it's only a wall." All of him said,
"Oh, since you put it like that, but what about the piano player?"
"I told you. I know just where to find one," said Glod.
A tiny part of him was amazed. "I've hacked a hole in my own wall. It took me days to nail that wallpaper on properly." Albert was in the stable with a shovel and a wheelbarrow.
"Go well," he said when Susan's shadow appeared over the half-door.
"Yes, I suppose."
"Pleased to hear it," said Albert without looking up. The shovel thumped on the barrow.
"Only... something happened which probably wasn't usual."
"Sorry to hear that."
Albert picked up the wheelbarrow and trundled it in the direction of the garden. Susan knew what she was supposed to do. She was supposed to apologize, and then it'd turn out that crusty old Albert had a heart of gold, and they'd be friends after all, and he'd help her and tell her things, and she'd be some stupid girl who couldn't cope. No. She went back to the stable, where Binky was investigating the contents of a bucket. The Quirm College for Young Ladies encouraged self-reliance and logical thought. Her parents had sent her there for that reason. They'd assumed that insulating her from the fluffy edges of the world was the safest thing to do. In the circumstances, this was like not telling people about self-defense so that no one would ever attack them. Albert picked up the wheelbarrow and trundled it in the direction of the garden. Susan knew what she was supposed to do. She was supposed to apologize, and then it'd turn out that crusty old Albert had a heart of gold, and they'd be friends after all, and he'd help her and tell her things, and she'd be some stupid girl who couldn't cope. No. She went back to the stable, where Binky was investigating the contents of a bucket. The Quirm College for Young Ladies encouraged self-reliance and logical thought. Her parents had sent her there for that reason. They'd assumed that insulating her from the fluffy edges of the world was the safest thing to do. In the circumstances, this was like not telling people about self-defense so that no one would ever attack them. Unseen University was used to eccentricity among the faculty. After all, humans derive their notions of what it means to be a normal human being by constant reference to the humans around them. And when those humans are other wizards, the spiral can only wiggle downwards. The librarian was an orangutan, and no one thought that that was at all odd. The reader in esoteric studies spent so much time reading in what the bursar referred to as the smallest room that he was generally referred to as the reader in the lavatory, even on official documents. The smallest room in Unseen University is in fact a broom cupboard on the fourth floor. He really meant the privy. The reader had a theory that all the really good books in any building At least all the really funny ones. The ones with cartoons about cows and dogs, and captions like, "As soon as he saw the duck, Elmer knew it was going to be a bad day," gravitate to a pile in the privy, but no one ever has time to read all of them, or even knows how they came to be there. His research was causing extreme constipation, and a queue outside the door every morning. The bursar himself, in any normal society, would have been considered more unglued than a used stamp in a downpour. The dean had spent 17 years writing a treatise on the use of the syllable enk in levitation spells of the early confused period. The arch-chancellor, who regularly used the long gallery above the great hall for archery practice, and had accidentally shot the bursar twice, thought the whole faculty was as crazy as loons, whatever a loon was.
"Not enough fresh air," he'd say. "Too much sitting around indoors rots the brain."
More often he'd say, "Duck!" None of them, apart from Ridcully and the librarian, were early risers. Breakfast, if it happened at all, happened around mid-morning. Wizards lined the buffet, lifting the big silver lids of the tureens and wincing at every clang. Ridcully liked big, greasy breakfasts, especially if they included those slightly translucent sausages with the green flecks that you can only hope is a herb of some sort. Since it was the Arch-Chancellor's prerogative to choose the menu, many of the more squeamish wizards had stopped eating breakfast altogether and got through the day just on lunch, tea, dinner and supper, and the occasional snack. So there weren't too many in the Great Hall this morning. Besides, it was a bit draughty. Workmen were busy somewhere up on the roof. Ridcully put down his fork.
"All right. Who's doing it?" he said. "Own up, that man!"
"Doing what, Arch-Chancellor?" said the senior wrangler.
"Someone's tapping his foot!"
The wizards looked along the table. The dean was staring happily into space.
"Dean,"
said the senior wrangler. The dean's left hand was held not far from his mouth. The other was making rhythmic stroking motions somewhere in the region of his kidneys.
"I don't know what he thinks he's doing," said Ridcully, "but it looks unhygienic to me. I think he's playing an invisible banjo, Arch-Chancellor," said the lecturer in recent runes. "Well, it's quiet, at least," said Ridcully.
He looked at the hole in the roof, which was letting unaccustomed daylight into the hall.
"Anyone seen the librarian?"
The orangutan was busy. He had holed up in one of the library cellars, which he currently used as a general workshop and book hospital. There were various presses and guillotines, a bench full of tins of nasty substances where he made his own binding glue, and all the other tedious cosmetics of the muse of literature. He'd brought a book down with them. It had taken even him several hours to find it. The library didn't only contain magical books, the ones which are chained to their shelves and are very dangerous. It also contained perfectly ordinary books printed on commonplace paper in mundane ink. It would be a mistake to think that they weren't also dangerous, just because reading them didn't make fireworks go off in the sky. Reading them sometimes did the more dangerous trick of making fireworks go off in the privacy of the reader's brain. For example, the big volume open in front of him contained some of the collected drawings of Leonard of Quirm, skilled artist and certified genius, with a mind that wandered so much it came back with souvenirs. Leonard's books were full of sketches. Of kittens, of the way water flows, of the wives of influential Ankh-Morpokian merchants whose portraits have provided his means of making a living. But Leonard had been a genius and was deeply sensitive to the wonders of the world, so the margins were full of detailed doodles of whatever was on his mind at that moment. Vast water-powered engines for bringing down city walls on the heads of the enemy. New types of siege guns for pumping flaming oil over the enemy. Gunpowder rockets that showered the enemy with burning phosphorus. And other manufactures of the Age of Reason. And there had been something else. The librarian had noticed it in passing once before, and had been slightly puzzled by it. It seemed out of place, and didn't appear to do anything to the enemy at all. His hairy hand thumbed through the pages. Ah, here it was.
Yes. Ah, yes. It spoke to him in the language of the beat.